talk about the female, one of our favorite subjects around this place. We have female reproductive system. We talked about the male last time. Now we're going to talk about the female anatomy, also the physiology. The sex differentiation, there's going to be a difference between the male and the female, if you haven't noticed. The male is going to look like a male, female, no. The male is going to have testicles. There are going to be analogous tissues are going to be the ovaries in the female. Remember when we had the indifferent gonads and we started from that? Okay. Remember that the ovaries were going to descend slightly in the abdomen, but the testicles were going to exit the abdomen. So they were going to sit in the what? Scrotum. That's also an analogous tissue to the labia majora in the female. Remember the labia majora was the large what? Large lips. We also have the sperm and egg being analogous tissues, whereas the sperm, of course, is a germ tissue as well as the egg. The penis, as you remember, was the erectile tissue in the male, and the clitoris was also the erectile tissue in the female. So we see that they're analogous tissues. And the reason that is because of what?
We all start out the same.
As?
Females.
Females. And then for some of us, something goes wrong.
Yes. But why is it the female that's... I'm going to stop myself. Why is the one so crazy?
Crazy?
Crazy.
Oh, you did it over there. Trouble.
Females aren't crazy. Remember, the female has more genetic information, so she knows more about what's up.
So they can process it.
So they have a tendency to go haywire.
Speaking of wiring, you remember that their corpus callosum is thicker than the male. So they're more perceptive, aren't they?
Yes.
And if they're more perceptive, maybe they see things, and therefore they're going to be more adamant about things. Whereas the male is going to be maybe more docile about things. Not as perceptive. How's that? Yeah, does that work? That got you out of hot water?
Not as perceptive, but more effective.
More effective.
Oh, okay.
Maybe.
Right on.
I'm not sure about that. Okay. When we look at the ovaries, we see that this is going to look a little bit like a unshelled almond. It's going to be about that big. We have the outside layer called the germinal epithelium. This is really misnamed because that would imply what if it's a germinal tissue?
Growing.
Yeah, something would be coming out of it. Nothing comes out of it. But it is fitting in that it does cover the ovary. So it would make sense that since that is a germinal tissue, the ovary, it'd be good to call whatever's going to be covering that a germinal tissue. We also have the tunica albuginea, which is going to be right next to that. That's going to be the tunica, or the what?
Coat.
It is.
Layer.
It is. Yes, that's what coats do. Albuginea means? Means? Albuginea?
White.
White, man. Like albumin, right, of the egg? There you go. So it's going to be that white area. And next then we have the ovarian cortex. This is where all the action takes place. And this area is going to be where we're going to have the development of the oocyte. So we're going to call it that, the ovarian cortex, whereas we're going to be getting our blood supply from the medulla, or the middle part. And you remember that the middle, of course, is always called medulla. The outside is always called cortex. So to remember these from superficial to deep, we remember the now famous mnemonic, Jerry to Al, court me. Jerry said to Al, court me. And Jerry, of course, stands for? Germinal epithelium. T-L.
Tunica
albuginea. And court me. Cortex. And M for? Medulla. So that's going to be superficial to deep, the histology of the ovary. So notice the process here. We're going to be going through the process of creating the follicle and ultimately having this process called what? Ovulation. And then we're going to be going into the vestigial stage of the ovary, and this is going to be considered the corpus what?
Luteum.
Corpus means?
Body.
Luteum means? Yellow. Then from there we're going to go into the corpus albicans. Albicans means?
White.
Like an alb. If you ever see a priest wear something white, they call that an alb. After albicans. Yes.
So the white part would be the end product of the white cycle.
This thing right here?
Yeah.
Yes. The corpus albicans. It's going to be the white body.
Okay. So it starts out as a primary follicle that goes to the oocyte.
Yes.
Are you going to go over all of this?
Yeah.
Later.
That's coming.
What happened next?
After this guy?
Yeah.
And that's it for that ovary, then the next one takes over. That's why you have two ovaries.
On the other side.
Yeah, well, it's going to basically just disappear and dissolve.
Phagocytosis. Alternate.
Not really phagocytosis. Yeah, you go one and the other, yeah.
So
that's why you have two.
Sorry, it starts at the corpus luteum. Is that right? Or no?
Corpus luteum?
Luteum, so that process starts there, or?
No, it starts up here.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Primordial follicle is where it really starts.
Okay, I see.
Yeah, it sort of starts there and then goes around and ends there.
Okay. So when it finishes with the white matter right there, right?
The corpus albicans, you mean?
Yes. Corpus albicans.
Yes.
Does its functions do something with the ovaries? Like, do they become like the eggs? That's what it is.
The corpus albicans?
Yeah, does it have
to do with him? No. Remember that a female is, from infancy, she's born with all her eggs. Remember that? So how many eggs does she have?
A certain amount.
Which is like 400. So she's born with 400 eggs. They're all in the suspended animation stage of metaphase, if you remember. We call those primary oocytes. That then is going to be one cell that's going to be then allowed to go through mitosis. Mitosis yields how many cells?
Four.
Well, mitosis does two, and then we go through meiosis, which is going to give us four. So it's going to go through meiosis, sorry. So we got meiosis occurring with four cells. Okay, then what happens is that you're going to be losing something. Right? Because how many eggs do you have?
Four.
Each month?
One.
So what has to happen?
You lose three.
You gotta get rid of three, right?
Yeah.
It's called chromosomal shedding. You just get rid of them. So now you have that one left. That's going to be your secondary oocyte, which is right there, in the secondary follicle. So your secondary oocyte is going to be really the oocyte that's going to be producing the child, if possible. Okay.
I don't understand how we get four.
Oh,
I know, and I didn't understand it last week.
Yeah, okay. Let's go over it, man. That's cool. So remember that we have 46 and 46 from the process of what?
Mitosis.
The process of mitosis produces two cells. Those two cells are going to have 46 each. These are going to be producing body cells, right? So if you cut yourself, your body's going to go through mitosis. It's going to produce the exact same cells with the exact same chromosomes, right? You could take one of those cells off and take those chromosomes and make your whole body, couldn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Yeah, the whole
body?
No.
From like your skin cell?
No, yeah. Just their heart.
No.
Whole body?
Well, the specific skin cell.
It's going to make the exact same cells, or no?
It's going to make that cell make exact same cells, but do you have the information to make your whole body in that one cell?
Yeah.
Yes, why?
Because it's your DNA.
Yeah, but why?
Because it's the same code.
Well, right. But why?
Because of mitosis, all you need is one cell, and then it goes through mitosis, and then it splits off into two cells, and then they go through mitosis, and then split off into that.
Four cells, and then eight cells. Yeah. But why does this cell have 46 chromosomes in it?
Because you have to have 46.
Right.
But why?
But why? Genetic code. Daughter cells, good, good.
Is it something like that?
Something like that.
Because the mom has 23 and the dad has 23, and when they come together, it makes 46.
Yes. You got it now. So why?
Because otherwise, if you didn't do it that way, you'd be like,
well, that's true. But follow Amanda's logic. You got mom meets pa. You get one cell. What happens to that one cell?
It splits.
It splits through the process of mitosis. And then it keeps doing it, right? Okay. So this cell was a product of what?
Mitosis.
So by definition, it came from that first cell, right? Agreed?
Yeah.
So it has to have what? It's got to have 46. Yes, it has to. Because it came from that one cell. All of our cells came from that one cell. That's why we have the 46. So that's why we have this process. Okay, so that's why we could take one of these cells from our skin and actually clone ourselves, couldn't we? Because we have all the information that we need to make our whole body. Because they came from one cell. Now that said, why does this skin only produce skin? Doesn't it have the information to produce a nose?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it would.
Does it have the information to produce a butt?
Yeah.
So why don't you have a butt growing out when you have like a cut? Why does a butt grow out of your hand?
Specific gene loci,
exactly. Remember, the DNA is a long strand, right? So it can only read one portion of that strand. It can't read the whole enchilada. It won't be allowed to, even though it has all the information there, right? And we made the analogy of you going into a library. If you went into a library, you wanted a cookbook with all the recipes, could you take out the book?
No.
No, because it's reserved. What could you do, though?
Make a copy.
You can make a copy of just that one page, right? And that's all that happens. Even though each cell has all of the genetic information, you can only take a copy of that one page. Your skin cell is only allowed to make skin. Yeah. And your butt's only allowed to make butt. Now, if we do this process again, this mitosis, we then will go into what we call meiosis. And meiosis is going to give us four cells. The difficulty here is they're not going to have 46, are they?
No,
23.
They're going to have 23. And that's called meiosis. And that's going to produce sex cells. And we all agree with that, don't we?
Yes.
That what?
Sex cells.
Sex cells, yeah. Okay. That's really why my classes fill up. Okay. So we have these cells now. These cells are going to not have 23, but rather half. So therefore we call these cells what?
Gametes.
Yeah, they're gametes, but we call them haploid. And these have the full measure, so we call them
diploids.
Half means half. Okay, so the female then, we're cool so far, Lisa? So not?
I got lost when you had, that each one only has half, 23 and 23.
Yeah.
It only has half of...
The other half doesn't make sense.
So the other half is your foster half. Your mom has half?
Yeah, your mom would give this part, and then in the sperm, and dad would give the other.
These aren't cells, these are the chromosomes.
These are all the chromosomes that are occurring.
These are cells, okay.
No, they're the chromosomes. These are cells, but in your gonads, this is what occurs.
Okay.
So we have this process.
And that's the only place that occurs.
Only place it occurs.
Just the sex cells.
Just the sex cells, yeah. So out of this, you're going to produce your one egg, or the male is going to produce lots and lots of sperm. Either way, because you only have one ovary, but the testicles has lots of seminiferous tubules, where lots of spermatogenesis is occurring. Cool. Okay. So then, what happens with the female is that we get chromosomal shedding. Since we only have one egg that's going to be coming to the fore, we're going to be nixing three of these guys. With that then, if we had, for instance, a D for Down syndrome, in three of them, would Down syndrome come to the next generation?
No.
This egg would be the only one that would be viable. Yeah. So by chromosomal shedding, we're going to increase the variety in our what? In our
gene pool.
Gene pool. Very good.
Yeah.
Okay. So yes, we're going to be getting rid of that. So it's going to be giving us variety. There's another thing. In meiosis, what's going to be occurring as well is genetic crossover, if you remember.
Yes.
So in this case, when the guys meet in the middle, which is called what?
Metaphase.
What's going to happen is they're going to cross over. If I was a chromosome, I wouldn't have a head, but I would have arms and legs. So what I would do is I would cross over. So my genetic information would go to the other side. So when I separate, now I have a combination of the genetics. So we got that? So you have...
So that one that's left of the 23 chromosomes is going to become the egg eventually?
Yes. So let's say you have this.
But it only has half information.
Only has half, yes. Okay, so we have a red chromosome, a blue chromosome. They come together in the middle. They do is they cross over. So the result is going to be a guy like this. And a guy like this, this, this. And this. So they crossed over and they shared their information. Now when they separate, you can see now how you get a mixture of genetic information with this one, as well as a mixture with this guy. See? See? Because they exchange their information. See? Not really. That's what happens, man.
So this right here is just one partner. That's not both.
It's the mother.
This is the mother,
okay,
in this case. Yeah. So you have this occurring up here, and then these guys are all going to be mixed together. They're going to have their chromosomes shuffled. So, you know, let's say that this was Down syndrome right there, and it comes across. Now, this chromosome could give Down syndrome, right? But if it gets shedded, then it won't, right? So that's the concept behind it. So those are the two things that are going to make a variety here. Okay, so we got that, I hope. Oh. Yes?
So when it's those three haploids are shed, they're not eggs yet?
No.
And how are they shed? They're just like recycled into...
They're just absorbed, yeah. They're just like...
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it possible for two of them to ever...
One. Yes, that can happen. You've heard of...
You can have two eggs getting fertilized.
Yeah, you can have... You must have had, like, breakfast one time. You open up the egg and there's two yolks in it.
Yolks.
Yeah, that can happen. And that would be exactly that scenario, Ann.
Those are the primordial follicles, or what?
Well, the primordial follicles have the secondary oocytes in them. And then they're just going to develop.
So
here they just call it oocyte.
So this is an oocyte?
Yeah, this is an oocyte.
She's asking about the 423s are oocytes.
No, these are not. They got shedded off.
Yeah, just
okay.
The only one that remains is the oocyte. And really,
like
technically.
Throwing away eggs. Throwing away. Because you know how you only have a certain amount of eggs?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, this is where I'm getting stuck.
It's sort of like we're throwing away eggs, yeah.
Oh, we are
throwing away. So that's 400
minus 4. If we
were to look at it like that? What happens is that it's in the stage of mitosis in metaphase. So that means you got this one cell here in metaphase. So it's going to go through this process twice. So at the end, you're going to get four cells. So you got your primary oocyte. These guys would be considered the secondary oocytes. So this process is going to occur. So you're born with 400 of these guys.
Right.
That's going to go through the process.
Each has the potential to make four.
Right.
Yes.
Wow.
So each one has the potential to make four. But it only makes one. So you only have 400.
Okay.
Yeah, because the rest of them are going to be shedded.
So that is what you have 400 of?
Yeah, you have 400 of these guys. And then when you go through this whole process, you're going to come down to one, but shed off three. So technically speaking, yeah, I guess you could say that these are super immature oocytes.
And what was it you said before? Meiosis is mitosis twice?
Yes, a meiosis is mitosis done twice. Because you go through the process once again.
Even though it's just half?
Yeah, okay. And you just half it. Because at the end of mitosis you get two, at the end of meiosis you get four. And like you say, you half these guys at the end of that.
And meiosis doesn't occur anywhere else except in the sex cells?
Yes.
Because mitosis is also the reduction.
Yes, that's true.
Mitosis is the
maintenance. Yeah.
And then the meiosis is the reduction.
Yes, that's good. That's true. Okay, glad we got that. So when we look at the ovary, we see it's going to be connected to the fallopian tube. That fallopian tube then is going to be attached to the uterus. The fallopian tube is going to have a variety of anatomical structures. The first one is going to be called the fimbriae. And fimbriae means what?
Fingers.
Fingers. So these are like little fingers that are going to beguile the egg to come into the fallopian tube. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. There's a potential space between the fimbriae and the ovary, and it's possible for the egg not to be brought in to the fallopian tube. So that egg then could go out and could be fertilized by the sperm that's coming up, right? Because sperm that's coming up is going to be able to go through that space as well. So it's possible to have a baby in your abdominal cavity growing, and that would be an ectopic pregnancy. And this characteristically is going to be an individual who will say, no, I was never pregnant. I mean, you know, I still had my period, and I, you know, I don't know what's going on. And I didn't even show. And then I go in for a bellyache, and they take an ultrasound. It turns out, I have a kid. So they had to do a cesarean, and they took out this kid, and he was premature, but he lives and breathes, and that happens about 11% of the time. So it can be quite often. Why doesn't she get big like she normally would?
It's the uterus.
Not in the uterus, yeah. Why would it grow, though, if it's not a uterus?
It still has to be supplying amniotic fluid in the sac and the placenta and the hormone.
Yeah, but why?
Still get the nutrients.
Why does it still get its nutrients?
Because it attaches to the closest place where it can get blood and oxygen, right?
Yeah, well, like, where would that be? Where is there a good...
It's very vascular.
Very good, yeah, very vascular. So you get attached anywhere in there. Any part of the mesentery would do it. Get a nice blood supply, and then, yeah, exactly what happens. You just start to grow your placenta, and everything else happens. But instead of growing forward, you're going to be growing inside, I guess, so you really don't notice it. Mm-hmm. But that's called an ectopic pregnancy. That's one of them. There's another one that's going to be called a tubal ectopic pregnancy, and that's going to be where the egg gets actually stuck. So when we look at the fimbriae, we go into the infundibulum. That's going to be next. And you remember the infundibulum from anatomy 2, the first chapter. We talked about something in your head that had an infundibulum. Remember?
That's the
pituitary.
It's held by the infundibulum.
Very good. The pituitary has this infundibulum, and the infundibulum means what?
Stalk.
Stalk? It's close.
Like a protrusion. Not really a protrusion.
No, it's
but
more like...
Funnel. Yeah, funnel. So it's like, doesn't that look like just like a funnel?
Yeah.
Got the sort of upside big part?
Down.
Yeah, upside down funnel. And then we go into the ampulla. The ampulla is usually where people get pregnant at. And then the isthmus is going to be connecting to the uterus. Like the isthmus of Panama. Is there an isthmus in Panama?
It's a thyroid.
It's a connection. Well, there's an isthmus right here and a thyroid too, that's right. Connects the two lobes. Fun to say at parties. You just say isthmus and people just like gather around you. I've done it many times. So we have the egg then being fertilized here in the ampulla. And as we said, if there's going to be any problem with the fallopian tube, such as maybe it, maybe the person had a pelvic inflammatory disease that was extreme and caused scarring in that area. Or maybe they had a tubal ligation. They decided they never wanted kids. And then they meet the right person and they decide they want to have kids and they want it reversed. Now you have scar tissue you have to deal with. So the sperm's going to be able to get in, right? But will the egg be able to get out? Maybe not. And if it doesn't get out, then you're going to be having the pregnancy occur here when it should be occurring here. And of course, that's a medical emergency. It'll grow enough. The person will be in so much pain that they just have to take it out. Yeah, Juan?
Would it like damage if it grew?
Yeah, they get lots of pain from it. It's got to be taken out.
So there wouldn't be a chance for a pregnancy then if that were to occur?
Well, I was thinking about that just today, in fact. I was thinking, I wonder if you could transplant that viable fetus into the uterus.
I don't know. Once you take it off, could you? I don't know.
Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, like sometimes you got a plant and you grow up from seed and you plant it, everything's cool. But then you decide later on that you don't really like where it is and you try to move it, and inevitably the thing will die, right? So I don't know how viable that is. They probably have thought of that, but it's probably not viable.
That's not a good idea because if you don't start originally,
Yeah, that's what I think. Yeah, that's what I think, probably.
Because one time I had a girl come into the ER and she had a miscarriage. And she was sitting down while her mother, the girl's 21, the mother's hangering. And she's like, let's get her inside fast, but she had a miscarriage. I'm like, okay, just left paperwork and get in when I get a chance. And I'm looking down when the mother started yelling. And then she's like, somebody take her in now. She pulled out a Ziploc bag out of the purse. And to me it looked like a meatball with tomato sauce in there. Yeah. When it was the actual placenta intact with the fetus, a 12-week fetus. That big. And she just had it on top of the counter.
Oh, cool, man.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I put gloves on. I was like, put it back there. But what we did, we took the patient to the back and we got the container and we put some sort of solution in there to keep the placenta intact that would damage it. And they took it upstairs to go through some tests to see what happened.
Oh, interesting.
You see the
reds,
the fingers, everything.
Wow, man. What a tragedy, huh? It was cool to see.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. Why put it in the bag?
Why didn't you just bring it to the hospital?
What else can you do? You can't, you might want to flush it.
I think it was a flush.
It's not a good idea to flush it. It'd be a good idea to take it to the hospital, of course. Well, they can do it.
Take it.
Have professionals take care of these things. You don't want your plumber coming to do that. You don't want that. Yeah, look at this. This is the reason you have this problem. So then we go into the uterus where we have this fundus, and that's going to be the top part. Let's look at the plumbing, speaking of plumbing. The ovary is hung close to the fallopian tubes, as we say, close to, notice, but they do not directly contact them. This area of the tube is called the infundibulum. The tube is 4 inches long. The purpose in life is to transport the egg to the uterus. So this is going to be 4 inches long. And the ampulla, the lateral part of the tube, is where the fertilization usually occurs. Fertilization must occur within 24 hours of ovulation. 7 days, the fertilized egg called the zygote arrives in the uterus. So it's 4 inches long, right? How long does it take to get from the ampulla to the uterus? How long?
No.
7 days.
7 days to go how far?
4 inches.
Well, the whole thing's 4 inches. Where's the ampulla?
Maybe three inches.
Yeah, maybe like halfway, right?
But does it move like in the stomach? Like churns and just push it?
The stomach churns and pushes it? Oh, you mean does this churn and push it? There are little cilia in there that assist in that. But these cilia aren't that adept, man. If you can't go 2 inches in 7 days, and plus it's going downhill, unless the person's laying down a lot, I guess. But, I mean, that seems pretty slow to me, but what do I know? Obviously, I didn't design it. Or been faster. I guess it doesn't matter. I guess it just develops and develops. It doesn't really matter when it gets there. It's sort of like, well, maybe we could take that as a lesson from life. It doesn't matter when we get there. Just take your time, man. It's going to happen. Take your time. That's right. You got 9 months more. Why not? What's the hurry? So we can call this the zygote. That's going to arrive in the uterus and then implant. The uterus is an inverted pear. We got the big part of the pear there, small part of the pear there. And that's going to be called, the top part is called the fundus. That's where the uterus has the most fun, I guess. I don't know. And then the end is going to be called the cervix. And the very, very hole at the end of the cervix is going to be called the os. Lateral to the cervix is going to be this area called the don't tell me.
Which asshole?
Call me that. Oh, the asshole? Whatever. That's good. I never heard that one before. I'll have to add that to my repertoire. Write that down. So when we look at the os, we want to do a procedure there. And what's the procedure going to be?
Would there be an abortion if you did an abortion there?
If you went in, yeah. That could cause an abortion, for sure. What? But just a general procedure, female procedure that they would have done. Pap smear. So what they do is they use a curette. So you take this little metal finger and stick it in the os. And you take this thing. Take this thing, and you're, how come I never heard of that before? Ever. I've been doing this for a while, and I would never let that pass by if I would have known about that. So you stick it in the cervical os, and then you rotate it around. And what you're doing is you're scraping the cervix with this thing. Of course, this was constructed by a male. If it was if the females ran the medical profession, it would be like, you know, coated in leather, it'd be real soft. And else, this is just a thing that sticks in and scrapes, you know, because they don't really feel that.
Be
warmer, wouldn't be so cold. Exactly. You'd be prepared for, you know, they tell you about it and whisper nice tones to you. Instead, they just jam it in there, rotate it around, and pull it out. Yeah, and they don't think that there's any pain sensors up there. It's all in the person's head. As if there's no nerves there. You know, as if they didn't learn anatomy. It's like, you know, as if they're, you know, you don't have a sacral and a lumbar plexus, you know? So, anyways. But that's the whole thing about the males dominating it. Like the mammary glands. Not really glands. The what are they called? Mammograms. You know, they take breast tissue, and what do? They just treat it lightly? Smash it. Why? Because it's male-dominated, man. Suppose that testicular cancer was as bad as breast cancer. I think we'd have a machine. Is that going to happen? Not a million years, man. Yeah, work on that. Yeah. If it was not male dominated, it'd be a whole different view of this whole thing, in my opinion, but that's my humble opinion. So the uterus or the womb has many purposes. It can have a pathway for sperm to reach the fallopian tubes. It's also the site of menstruation. It's also going to be the site of implantation of the fertilized ovum. So we can see we have a variety of things. The development of the fetus, we will also call it the oven. So they have a bun in the oven, if you've heard that expression. There was a woman who was born without abdominal muscles, so she just had a thin fascia. She could actually see inside. So each of her kids all had a womb with a view. Work on that, Ellie. just forget that one. Okay. So feminine ligaments, we have the broad ligament, which is going to be indeed broad, anchoring the uterus as well as the ovary. The ovary also has a separate ligament called a suspensory ligament. We also have the ovarian ligament that actually attaches to the ovary. The suspensory ligament is going to actually suspend the fallopian tube. These can become very taut in some individuals. Some individuals are born with these guys a little bit tighter than most. These individuals then, when they do have a menses, will cause contraction of their uterus, which is the normal process, but the difficulty is that because they cannot stretch as well, the individual gets pain and discomfort, and that's called what? Cramps, yeah. Dysmenorrhea is the technical term. And that can be because of an increased levels of certain hormones, as we'll talk about. Now, when we look at the vagina, that's going to be our next area. So that's going to be what we're talking in here now. We see that just lateral to the cervix is going to be that area called the fornix. Then we're going to go into the vagina proper. We're going to be seeing that we're going to be having a number of structures there, such as the rugae. Why would we have rugae there?
For room.
Yeah. Remember we had muscles in the stomach, and they created the rugae, so those are muscular. So this indeed is also muscular. So the rugae makes sense that we would have them there. And as Adrian mentioned, it's also going to be for what?
Friction.
For friction. Why would you want friction? Because it's a rugae. So that would be for who?
The guy.
The guy, yeah. Yeah, always comes down to that, doesn't it? The fornix is going to be the area where the penis will actually be able to go into, that little vestibule there, either side. Then it's expansive, so it's going to be able to take, shall we say, large or small individuals, depending. Doesn't really matter because all you have to do is just get in the vagina. Anywhere is fine. It's like they asked Abe Lincoln, how long should a person's legs be? Because he was such a tall guy. And he said, long enough to reach the ground. Same thing here. Long enough to reach the vagina. That's all we need. So it's going to be an acidic medium because it's going to retard bacterial growth. As you know, acid is going to decrease bacterial growth because bacteria produce acid, so it would be like floating in their own waste products. So they would not want that. So it's going to be acidic. The downside of making it acidic is that you're going to be having the semen. It's going to be, could potentially be destroyed by the acidity. So what do? You have the sperm. You have semen that's going to be neutralizing it. So in semen, there's actually Arm & Hammer baking soda. No, not really. But there are solutions in the semen that are actually going to neutralize the acidicness of the vagina so that the sperm will be able to be viable. So really, as we said before, the semen really is a transport medium for the sperm. And the hymen is going to be a border around the orifice of the vagina, partially closing it. And there's the hymen. It's a signal of what?
Virginity.
Virginity, right? If the person has a hymen, then the assumption is that they have not had intercourse. When we look at the external genitalia, we'll see that we have the whole area called the pudendum or the vulva. And we have the mons pubis, which is going to be an elevated area of the pubic bone. Why is it elevated more in the male or in the female than the male?
Childbirth.
Remember that the pelvis is shaped differently, right? Mons means what?
Mountain.
So it's literally a mountain of the pubic bone covered in pubic hair. And then we descend into the labia majora, the large lips, and then the labia minora is going to be the smaller ones. And then the clitoris is going to be that erectile tissue. It's going to be right at the top of the meeting of the two lips. Then we have our triangle, and that's going to be called the really diamond back there, made of two triangles. So the perineum, which is going to be that bottom portion, is going to be called the diamond. We have two triangles. We have the anterior triangle, which is going to be having its border being these things called the what? Yeah, Yes, those are the ischial tuberosities on there. On there. That's where you're sitting on right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
The anterior border is going to be what? The pubic bone, yes. Pubic bones together, or the pubic symphysis. And posteriorly, we're going to have the what? The coccyx, yeah. So the coccyx posterior. So we see how we make a diamond out of that. Cut that in half. Now we have a triangle. We have the urogenital triangle anteriorly. Why? Urogenital.
Because the urethra and the genitals.
Urethra and the genitals. Good. And the posterior one's going to be called the what?
The douche.
The anal triangle, if you don't mind. So, what exercise... It's okay. What exercise strengthens the perineum?
Kegels.
The Kegels exercise. How do you do the Kegels?
We squeeze.
You squeeze, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hold your breath and squeeze. Yeah, you can do that. To teach it to a patient, what you would say is? To teach it to a patient, what you would do is say is, you have to pee in and stop it. So it's called the stop and go exercise. After they learn how to do that, then they don't no longer need to pee to know how to do it. They can do it anywhere. So I recommend, since we call it the stop and go exercise, that they do it at every red light if they're driving. So you get a red light, stop and go. So it can help strengthen this. Why would females have more of a problem with the perineum than the male? Because what?
Childbirth's
a big one. What else? If a person never had children, she could still have problems in this area.
Relatively short length from the urethra to the bladder.
That would be infections. What we're talking about here is incontinence. What's incontinence? Can't hold your urine, yeah. You laugh and you pee. Also, bladder ptosis, what would that be? Bladder ptosis.
Oh, it's a dropping of the bladder.
Dropping of the bladder. Also, we could have uterine ptosis. So that's also dropping. All these are not being supported by the muscle, right? Okay, so, why would that be in the female more than in the male, other than childbirth? Why would that be?
Because over time...
Bigger space. Why bigger space?
Because the uterus takes more space.
The hips are bigger.
Child.
Bearing it
more space. More space, so therefore a female has a wider...
Wider area.
Pelvis. Her pelvis is wider. So therefore the male is shorter, so the pudendum's like a, let's say it's a hammock. So the hammock's just going to be like, you know, hanging, right? Now you got this bigger area, the hammock's going to have more, hang more loose. So you got to try to strengthen that more. But the male can also receive benefits from doing the Kegels as well, because what's sitting right on these muscles? Sitting right on those muscles.
Prostate.
So he can get advantages from that, doing the Kegels by helping his prostate gland. Kegels.
I do it every weekend.
Every weekend?
Every weekend.
I do it when I do my regular exercise every day. I do the downward dog and the Kegels. Sometimes upward dog and the Kegels, depending on how I feel. Yes, Mike.
What are these paraurethral and greater vestibular glands?
The paraurethral, where are they? Oh, paraurethral.
And the one right below it?
The greater vestibular glands?
Yeah.
No idea.
Okay.
You raise a good point. I shouldn't put anything in these notes that I don't know all about.
Never think of glands down there, what their names are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there was a thing that said that was external genitalia.
Right.
Or the greater vestibular gland. I've never seen that.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. Yeah. Vestibular would imply balance. Paraurethral, of course, would be outside the urethra. Okay. Now the breasts. Two mammary glands are modified sudoriferous glands. Sudoriferous, as you remember, were sweat glands. They produce sweet milk, unless the woman doesn't like the kid. Then who knows? They're anterior to the pectoralis major muscle. The axillary tail in the armpit contains many lymphatic vessels, so it's a common site for breast cancer. Smooth muscle can contract, causing wrinkling of the skin and erecting the nipple in response to cold, touch, or arousal. And around the nipple, then, is this area called the what? Areola. And the areola is going to be having areas of the sebaceous glands. So what's a sebaceous gland?
Oil.
Oil. Why would we want to secrete oil around the nipple?
Prevent shaving.
Yeah. So if you're like running, you wouldn't chafe?
Well, breastfeeding.
During breastfeeding, yes. How would that benefit the...
When dry out,
exactly. You got it. And when we breastfeed, or when we have breastfed, if we ever have, did we suck on the nipple? Yes, we latched, didn't we? We latched on the whole areola. Unlike when you see, like, you know, the bottles that they give kids, they're sucking on the nipple, right? It would be analogous to having the mouth go all the way at the end of the nipple, and they actually latch there, so that the nipple's inside their mouth. And really what they're sucking on is the areola. That's the perfect thing. And that's called the latch. A lot of women don't realize that, so they need to be taught that. So that's the way it works. And if we look at the suspensory ligaments, we see these are going to be defying gravity. And these are called Koop's ligaments. And a bra would counter Koop's droop. Around that nipple is a colored area called the areola. It's not made of what kind of tissue? Areolar tissue, remember areolar tissue in anatomy 1? No?
Yeah.
Remember areolar tissue?
Yeah.
Modified sebaceous glands, as we said. Now the anatomy of the lactating breast is that we're going to be having the milk emerging through the nipple from the lactiferous ducts to the breast and then exiting the nipple. The path of milk is through the process called lactation. Lactation, as you remember, is going to be under the influence of two hormones. First hormone is going to be prolactin. Remember that? Prolactin is going to be doing what?
Stimulating the production of milk.
We still haven't gone far enough yet. We produce the milk, but now what do we have to do? We've got to have oxytocin to do what? Eject. Remember, it was the ejecting and effecting hormone? So it's going to assist in ejecting the milk. So if we had that problem that we talked about where the person had a problem with pregnancy, they couldn't have a natural childbirth because they didn't have enough oxytocin and they were given oxytocin, it might be a problem for them to do what? Breastfeed later on, right? Because of the contact inhibition. So it's a possibility. So when we look at the process, yes?
Now when people have like breast augmentations, does it like it usually like press against them? Does it like cause like problems with that?
Great question.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens in breast augmentation. That's something I've been wanting to look up, and I never have.
I just had
but I understand. Yeah.
That she gave birth probably 3 months ago, and she had to go back to the breast surgeon because one of those ducts got
clogged.
She actually had an extended leave. You normally get 3 months for pregnancy. She got to get like another extra month because of the problem with the breast. But you don't know that until you get to that.
Stage.
They put it so you can breastfeed. But you don't know if you're going to have a complication until after.
So she had a breast augmentation?
She had a breast augmentation before the baby. And a year after, now she has the baby. And she didn't know this was going to happen. It happened after she started trying to latch the baby. She was having severe pain, and it was one of the dogs was.
So it must have got twisted around or whatever.
She gained it or...
Yeah. Well, I understand that one of the ways I can do it is actually go underneath the pec muscle. That's the pec minor, so it'd be pec major. And they put a bag underneath there. That would push the breast tissue forward. If she has really small breasts, I guess I would still push it forward enough to make them look bigger. Or, as I understand, they can also go just in front of the pec muscle. So I don't know which is better. I would imagine if a person's going to be like weightlifting, you wouldn't want a bag of solution back here. Then as they increase their strength, of that, wouldn't that cause smaller breasts? I don't know. I'm confused.
Wouldn't that squish everything together, though?
Yeah, exactly. And it's a muscle, right? So muscles are constantly pushing.
What kind of tissue is all the, in the center then, the pink?
This stuff? Well, that's all fat.
The adipose, but what's inside it?
This? Just connective tissue. Yeah. That's a good question. You know, and obviously sometimes there's downsides to it. And I guess women that have larger breasts basically have more fat, right? I think that's the difference. I mean, this shouldn't change. Certainly, women that have small breasts are able to breastfeed as well, so the mechanism must be the same. The difference just must be the fat component, I guess. So fat, milk forms in the tubules, the lobules first. Then it flows to the secondary tubules, mammary ducts, lactiferous sinuses, lactiferous ducts, and then out the nipple. Your book will say something else, but you know who to go with. So we use this mnemonic, lost MD to LSD. So L for what?
Lobules.
ST?
Secondary tubules.
MD.
Mammary ducts.
LS.
Lactiferous sinus.
And LD. For lactiferous ducts. Speaking of breast milk, it's important to advise the new mother to at least try to breastfeed for 7 days. 4 days is optimal, but 7 days would be even better if they can just do it and hang in there. But after 4 days, the individual, the baby's gotten the colostrum usually, which gives the kid a heads up as far as their immune system's concerned. Because it's sort of like transferring what the person's already went through, that what the mother already went through as far as infections and stuff.
Antibodies.
And antibodies, yeah. So it's like the kid's got this memory of the mother in a way, of all the things she went through. So it's a real beneficial thing. It gives them a head start as far as their immune system's concerned. So at least 4 days. If they don't want to do it after that, then you know, try to push them a few more days just to try to get the colostrum going. And sometimes the only reason they won't do it is because they're not doing it properly. They're doing it with the nipple rather than with the areola. Sometimes that's the only reason. Or they're just grossed out by it. They don't want to do it. But you might want to mention that there are some advantages. And the best advantage is this.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if they're reluctant, just say, oh, by the way, it has been shown that breastfeeding can cause rapid weight loss. Just mention it casually. You could say that it's very good for the kid, decrease heart disease, also decrease allergies, decrease cancer, GI problems, and infections. That might be enough, but usually not. Yeah. Weight loss.
That's a winner.
You could say also it's going to decrease your breast cancer risk and also osteoporosis, and they may go, what else do you have? Well, it could cause weight loss. Maybe I'll try it. I don't want to go on TV and one of those Biggest Losers, right?
So it's only recommended for at least 7 days?
Well, some women don't want to do it at all.
They don't want to do it.
They don't want to do it at all. So at least get them to do it for 7 days. That would be ideal. I mean, you know, just try to do it for 7 days. But some women just don't want to do it. That's all there is to it. They'd rather do formula, and that's all. Well, then that's their decision, but certainly be good to encourage them. What's that? Saggy boobs. Does it cause breastfeeding? Does that cause that? No. No, well, that's probably one of the myths, maybe. But that's not going to be it. Because if you're breastfeeding, well, the idea is you're breastfeeding, you got more weight there, so that's going to screw up the ligaments, the Cooper's ligaments. But that's not necessarily the case. Good point, though. Cosmetically. So how do cows keep giving us milk?
Because they are happy cows.
Because they're contented cows. Yeah, they have to have kids, right? They have not kids. What they be called?
Yeah,
calves. They have to have calves continually, right? But there's a period where if you were to stop. Well, have you ever met anyone who's been breastfeeding since they've been like a teenager?
I saw it on the forum.
Yeah. How old were they?
Even they started breastfeeding. Breastfeeding for like 6 years.
So would that be high?
7 years or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, the oxytocin's going to be high all that time, yeah.
So like dairy?
Till 7?
Well, the kid was
down. I saw that on the beach, Mom.
On the beach? There's a 6-year-old kid breastfeeding?
Yeah, running around.
Yeah.
Wow, man.
Dairy cows would have to have a calf first, and then just by continually milking that cow, it would still become...
Yeah, eventually though they could dry up, and if they did, then they would have to have another calf. But yeah, people can go 6 years.
So you cannot breastfeed as long as the baby is taking milk. I mean, at some point you will dry out, even if
not necessarily, but it does happen. Yeah. Particularly around the 5th year, I would think it's trying to dry up. The same thing, yeah. That would stimulate it.
You can't breastfeed, right?
Well, you can breastfeed, sure. Yeah, that's the best scenario. Yeah. I would say what, year and a half would be max. About time the kids a year and a half. About time the teeth come in.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because they do.
Yeah. Less than a year.
Maybe less than a year.
I get it when they're 10 months.
Yeah. When they're walking. Yeah, 6 months?
Yeah.
8 months?
Or eight.
As soon as they start walking, forget it.
I wonder if Kate Gosling breastfed.
I don't know, who is she?
John and Kate plus eight.
No.
Oh, yeah.
Probably not.
Probably not. The Octomom, she should be breastfeeding.
Pump her like a cow.
Pump her like a cow. Should be contented. So cow's milk is not a good substitute for human milk because cow's milk has decreased fat. Human milk has more fat. Why?
The brain.
Brain. Yeah, myelin sheaths. And increased protein in the cow's milk, decreased protein in the human milk. Why is that?
Because the protein doesn't go through
the products,
right?
Why? No, the protein goes in. It just doesn't produce it as much. So as Lisa was saying, you got... Yes?
Herbivores.
Were herbivores?
Less protein.
Herbivores have less protein in their milk. Hey, that's good. Way to go. Now see, what he just did was relate past information with this information. That's good. It's good to do.
So it has decreased fat because...
Well, it has more increased protein because... Yeah, because of the fact that they need to walk around. So as Lisa was saying, you know, when they're walking around, it's not a bad idea to stop with milk. Yeah. They're herbivores. Cows. Yeah. So cows need to walk right away, don't they? Yeah. Okay. So it's harder to digest, of course, cow's milk, and you're going to get the diaper rash because you're going to have nitrogenous waste. Why would you get nitrogenous waste?
Protein,
right?
Yeah.
That's the side effect of too much protein is nitrogen, right? As we talked about when we talked about
kidneys.
The kidneys. Very good. 10% of women can become pregnant again while nursing, so it's not a good way of having a contraceptive, I don't think.
But it does decrease the chance.
It definitely decreases the chance.
Very little.
No. Yeah. But decreases the chance 90%. I mean, you know. But not bad. Now, oogenesis and the sexual cycle. Oogenesis is the formation of the eggs and the ovaries, as we talked about. and this is basically what we already reviewed. The thing is that we have a sexual cycle are the events occurring every month. If pregnancy does not occur, we're going to go through the sex cycle again. So it keeps going and going every month. We're going to talk about it as far as the ovarian and menstruation cycle. So the person is going through these processes at the same time, basically. The reason for the increase in endometrial lining is what?
To line the uterus.
Why?
Because it sheds,
yeah. Why have an increased lining?
Nutrition
for the kid, right? So we're hoping that the egg will become fertilized in what part of the fallopian tube?
The ampulla.
Ampulla. It will then go down into a viable uterus that has an increased
lining.
What kind of lining?
Endometrial
lining. Good. And then it's going to be just like a soft pillow. It just goes, hangs out there. If that does not happen, then we got to get rid of that, right? Got to get rid of the endometrial lining. Of course, that's going to be called
menstruation,
or menses. Right? It's going to be shedding. So here's our events again. We're going to go from the primordial follicle to the primary follicle with our oocyte inside. Remember, this is going to be our secondary oocyte, but now we're just going to call it the oocyte. Our follicle will start to develop. As it does develop, it will ultimately go to the outside layer called the germinal epithelium, and it will burst through. It actually hemorrhages. So the ovary hemorrhages the oocyte. So that's sometimes why an individual will have discomfort, because of actually bleeding of the ovary. Then after that, then the follicle will now become the corpus what?
Luteum.
And then it will go into the corpus albicans. At this point, it's going to be where we're going to be having something like luteum. What's that hormone going to be called?
Luteinizing hormone.
So we're going to be seeing a spike of luteinizing hormone when we get ovulation. So the three phases of the female reproduction are going to be, first of all, it's going to be starting with menarche, and some say when menarche, because menarche to what?
Getting pregnant,
yeah. This stops at menopause. Pause means to stop what?
Menses.
So you can't get pregnant after that, supposedly, although it has happened. Lasts about a month, this reproductive phase. First of all, you have the follicular phase. This is where the menstrual phase and the preovulatory phase. Then we slide into the ovulation, which is a central important event. And then we go to the postovulatory phase. So the follicular phase really is a preovulatory phase, but because we're concentrating on creating the follicle, we call it the follicular phase. So that's going to be all in here. Follicular phase, then what happens?
Ovulation,
and then?
Post.
So when we look at F, we see we're going to have the follicle. That's going to be this. We have ovulation, which is the sunburst. Then we have the L for corpus luteum, and then the A for corpus albicans. So that's our general events in the ovary. And of course, it looks just like Florida, doesn't it? With a sunburst in the middle. No, that's a good question. No, you can have that occurring anywhere. Yeah, varies. Good question. Notice these guys, these fembrae.
Mm-hmm.
See how there's a big space. Okay. Now we start with our ovarian cycle. Remember, there's two things happening. One is this, the uterus. The other one is what's going on in the ovary itself. So in the uterus, we have the menstrual phase. That's going to be where we're going to be having our endometrial lining shedding, or is it going to be building up?
Shedding.
Then we're going to go to the preovulatory phase. During this phase, what's happening to the endometrial lining?
Rebuilding.
Very good. And then in this phase, what's happening to it?
Ovulation.
Right after ovulation, that's the ovarian phase. But what's happening in the uterus? It all depends, doesn't it?
Yeah.
it will start to shed once we get to this area, and the shedding will be dependent upon what?
Fertilization.
So if this guy gets fertilized, then this is going to remain. If it doesn't get fertilized, then this is going to start the shedding process about right there. Okay. Then we will actually have menses here. Around 28 days or so. So right at the middle of our ovarian phase is going to be our developing follicle. Then right in the middle, ovulation, and then our involution of that. And then notice how the new follicles then starting right in here. So here's like what Juan was asking about, what happens to the corpus luteum. It comes to the corpus albicans, and then it's going to corpus luteum, corpus albicans, and you see how small it is, and eventually it just involutes.
Is that release estrogen?
Corpus luteum is going to release this stuff, which is called what? Luteinizing hormone. FSH, which is going to be what?
Follicle-stimulating
hormone is going to also peak, but it also goes down a little bit too. Why would it go down?
Because it only has CDF or to ovulate.
Yes, but why would the follicle-stimulating hormone go down?
It's another one, yeah.
Yes, exactly. You don't really want, you're really high here in development. Once it's developed, you don't need to develop it any longer once it's mature, so it's going to be decreasing. And then, of course, then you're going to be raising it up as you're getting here, because now your corpus albicans is coming, and here's your new follicles, so you want it to start to rise as well.
But then if you get pregnant, it just stays down.
Yes.
So when ovulation occurs, the uterus is actually going through a breaking down phase?
It starts to break down right in there.
Okay.
No, sorry, not breaking down yet. It'll start to break down in here. Yeah, it's not breaking down yet. Because it doesn't know whether or not the kid's coming.
Oh, okay, so it doesn't know, and then I guess it's kind of preparing. It's like it's
yes.
Then kind of thing.
Cool. No, it's preparing for pregnancy.
Okay.
And if that doesn't happen, then it's preparing to get a new lining, which is going to be happening right in there.
Okay, I'm just wondering why it doesn't have that lining there when ovulation occurs, I would think.
It is there.
But it's starting to get broken down, though.
No. It's going to get started broken down in this area.
Oh, okay.
That's the start of it, and it's actually going to be shed in this area.
Okay, I was thinking at like that 14th, 15th day there, that it just starts to break down.
No.
Okay, so there's a few days.
Yeah.
Where, okay. Perfect.
That was the progression of fertilization down. It took 7 days. Ovulation just takes it's basically a day. Yeah. The egg is going to be viable for 24 hours. Ovulation just takes, you know, imagine a minute or two. Yeah. Yeah. But we have to add something else, and that is that the sperm can be viable for how long? About 3 days. So now, theoretically, if you deposit a sperm on day one, and then you ovulate it on day three, you could still get pregnant, theoretically. So there's a 4-day window, really. It should probably be expanded, given the fact that you don't know when ovulation is occurring. You could have had, ovulation could be occurring on day one, and then you had sex on day three, and then you could get pregnant then, right? Yeah, because... Could you? Yeah, after the ovulation? No, if you're after, it doesn't matter, right? So if you could find out when ovulation occurs and not have sex before then, you know when it occurs and you won't have sex afterwards, then you'd be pretty good, right? You'd be able to figure out when to have sex and when not. And also you could reverse it too, right? You could determine when to have sex if you wanted a kid. So you could do it either way. So after is not that big of a deal. It's the before part. Yeah, so it's a good question. The ovulation kits, well, how can you find that out? Well, how do they find that out? All they do is they just depict when LH is going to be highest. and you pee on it, and then it says, oh, that's the highest, so you know. The thing is though, are you going to pick the right day? Because it's going to peak, you got that 24 hours, right? So you got to try to pick the right day. You can do that with like cervical mucus, you can do that with temperature, a spike in temperature. You can also do that with the Mickel smirks, if you happen to have that. That's it, that's Mickel smirks. You can feel it. So all those things put together, plus the luteinizing hormone spike, you're pretty assured that that's the time when ovulation occurred. So therefore, then you could have sex when? Afterwards. Then you might want to wait a few days, 3 days. You got to build up, man. Do it every 2 days, you're just going to be shooting blanks after a while. You got to build it up. Yeah, for sure. Because remember that the sperm is produced, and then it's stored where? Epididymis, right? And that's where it's going to mature. So it's got to have time to mature, or else you're going to be sending out, you know, guys that aren't mature yet. It's like soldiers that haven't been, you know, through boot camp. I would guess probably 3 to 4 days or so. So maybe sex once a week would probably do it. Yeah. Second round's probably, yeah. Third round, they're just limping. You still don't want to play with that, if you're pardon the expression. Because, you could still get pregnant with the third group. You just never know. It may be like, you know, a Rambo in there. Okay, we have the discharge of menstrual flow there. We have the follicle advancing to the grafting stage. It's going to be our ovarian events. And the follicle is going to decrease the FSH, as we said, because it's now matured. You get that spike of LH. And then we're going to have the luteinizing phase. And then this is when we get into our progesterone. Progesterone is going to be increasing. Progesterone is going to be a hormone for what? Yes. Keeping the pregnancy, right? Progestation wants to keep the pregnancy. If that does not occur, then of course the natural products would be to decrease progesterone and then menstruation occurs. You can see how menstruation is going to be tied in with progesterone. Also, estrogen is going to be tied in with progesterone. Because as we increase estrogen, what happens to progesterone? Decreases, so they're antagonistic. So in this case then, as estrogen increases, progesterone will decrease. Speaking of increase and decrease progesterone, if we have low progesterone, that would mean the individual is not going to be very likely to get pregnant, right? Is that possible? If you have low progesterone, it's possible that the person may be in jeopardy of not getting pregnant. They want to get pregnant and they can't. Why? Because we have to have a surge in what? In progesterone, right after the egg comes out, right? We have to have that surge. The surge is not there. So if the person has, so if they have low progesterone, then that process isn't going to occur. So their estrogen is going to be essentially higher, right? Now you have a situation where it's not that good for pregnancy to occur. Also, the individual has symptoms of dysmenorrhea. Why? Because that's going to cause the pelvic ligaments to not relax. If you have lots of progesterone, those pelvic ligaments are going to be relaxing. Why? They're expecting a kid. And they want that uterus to be relaxed, right? Go to cushion support it. If the progesterone is low, then the person could experience this, and they may not be able to get pregnant as well. Dysmenorrhea is painful menses. Exactly. Now, some people can have excessive progesterone. Now, you would think that these individuals would be more likely to become pregnant. Au contraire. Because what they have is a late menses of long duration. Now, their whole cycle is thrown off. You've heard of people have, they can never figure out when their cycle's coming or going or whatever. That's usually because of the excessive progesterone idea. And that's going to cause a scanty flow because it's going to be so much, it's going to be such a long duration, but it's not going to be enough to build up enough of the endometrial lining. You also have excessive estrogen. Now, excessive estrogen is going to give you a heavy menstrual flow, and that makes sense. It's going to last 7 days or longer, because excessive estrogen, increased estrogen, is going to do what to progesterone? Decrease it. So it makes sense that we want to get rid of the endometrial lining. It's through the whole thing. And it's going to be really dependent on progesterone. If progesterone goes up or down, that's what estrogen does, just the opposite. Estrogen is really more in the beginning. So it's throughout, but it's more operative. If you have a decrease of estrogen, you're not going to be getting pregnant. Or if you have an increase of estrogen, you're not going to be getting pregnant. Which one? Increase estrogen. What's that going to do to progesterone? Decrease it. So what are the birth control pills made of? Estrogen, which causes what to happen? Right. Progesterone for pregnancy, right? Now you don't have any because you have so much estrogen. Yeah, it can't be good. But for some people that have, for instance, this low progesterone, if they had the birth control pill, would that help them? They have low progesterone, will that make them feel better? They're going to decrease it even more, right? And yet, one of the treatments for when a female's situation is screwed up, so they will give them the birth control pill even if they don't want to become pregnant, or if they don't want to prevent pregnancy. And some kind of that can regulate. Yeah. Most of the time, if you have excessive progesterone and you give estrogen in the form of a birth control pill, that will help them with that. So that will get them more normal. If they have a low progesterone situation, it may make it even worse, right? So here's a person that's low progesterone, she doesn't want to get pregnant, she decides to go on the pill. Now every month she's got these, you know, these menses that, like, you know, throw her out for a day or two. Can't go to work or whatever else. And before it wasn't that bad. That might be one of the reasons why. But she could become pregnant. If she became pregnant, what would happen? She'd increase her progesterone, wouldn't she? She'd have 9 months of high progesterone. What would that do to her ligaments? Relax them. Then she's got this weight in there of the kid, right? What does that do to the ligaments? Loses them too, right? She has a kid, and now no more dysmenorrhea. So that can be a treatment for that. But then you have another pain, usually a pain in the breast. Okay, so let's talk about how we could take care of these things. If you have decreased progesterone, you of course want to increase it, right? That would be the treatment. How are you going to increase progesterone? Well, you can use a cream, which is the yam cream. It's called progesterone cream. It comes from the yams. It's natural. You rub it on the fatty parts underneath your arm, inside your thighs, and the body will absorb as much as it needs. So therefore, you have decreased progesterone, or if you have a situation where you have painful menses, you want to consider that. That's where they come out with the song. You've heard that song? Stand by your yam. And that really means put it on your thigh, your yam. Okay. So then we can also have too much progesterone. Treatment for that would be to do what? Yes, you'd want to decrease the progesterone, but the thing is that you can't really do that. But you can, yes, want to increase estrogen. How do you do that? Well, you would give them the birth control pill. If you want to go natural, you could say, why don't you take phytoestrogens? What would a phytoestrogen be? In plants, such as soy. Soy is loaded with phytoestrogens. You take soy milk, you take whatever soy, and rub it on your thighs. No, you don't drink it. Yeah, but never be able to take it. But try to mitigate some of the negative effects of increased progesterone. Now, suppose you have too much estrogen. What do you want to do? Yams, which would do what? Increase progesterone. Well, that's yams. Indeed. The increased progesterone will decrease estrogen. Now let's say you have decreased estrogen. Yes. Increased estrogen. How are you going to do that? Well, so tofu, you know, tofu. This one vegan, she wanted her license plate. So she's put into the DMV. I love tofu. 7 letters. Nip, take. 9, 10, 10. Can't do that. I guess you could do that. ILB. Does that work? They wouldn't let her do it though. You know why? Well, fill it out. So they wouldn't let her do that. Okay. Let's talk about, speaking of that, let's talk about the sexual response. Okay, so when we first start off, we have, this would be like a transection. We're looking through your legs. Transection. So, understand the uterus, understand it in a non-stimulated state. Sort of snuggles up against the bladder. When it becomes stimulated during excitement, what happens is that the bladder goes, or the uterus goes down against the spine, close to the spine anyways. This makes more sense because you want the sperm to be able to travel sort of like not uphill, right? When the male produces the sperm inside of the vagina, it's going to be going right into this area called the what? Cervix. This is the fornix, right? And as we said, this is the expanded area. So a larger penis will just expand the fornix. You notice still the uterus is down. And then as the orgasm occurs, you get a spasm of the uterus. So we get an actual dipping of the cervix into the seminal fluid.
I'm concerned about the guy.
But the female orgasm is going to be actually allowing for this to dip into the semen. Semen will remain there, of course, the sperm's going off. And that's during resolution. The reason for the orgasm is simply to keep the female in a bath. So that this isn't going to come. As long as she's laying down. Still get pregnant. You still have a rumble. Have a rumble. if it does happen, that the person gets pregnant, this is what happens. There's a kid growing in there. It seems like a fairly compromised situation, so to say. The bladder being pushed against the pubic bone. So of course, they want to go to the bathroom a lot. They have their descending colon and ascending colon transition, so they push it away to the side. Their small intestine used to be here. Now it's up there. Push it against the liver. Push it against everything else. Against the diaphragm. Heart problems. The rump. The stomach's way up here. It should be right down there. Oh, yeah. You name it. Everything's not working. But it's love. Think about it. You know. Just happened. That's called gestation, as I mentioned about progesterone. It's a gestation. It lasts about 266 days. And that's over 9 months, wouldn't you say? Like 10 months. So the gestational calendar is measured from the first day of the woman's last menstrual period. Where it's predicted to happen 280 days after that. Not 9 months. Why are they saying 9 months? Well, they want to do it in trimesters. That's the big reason. And so it's really a trimester and a half. You can say 3 trimesters. But you're right. It's really yeah, just early. There's a little kid. I think it's like its foot, it's like it's through the... I think it's a little cold, isn't it? The average is 266 days of protection to birth. But they, yeah. Probably wouldn't ask what you're doing. But I might. But I might ask. 266. That's the average. But they do the endurance for 80 days. That's how they calculate. So I guess they always calculate that you're going to be under their calculation. So after birth, the mother's anatomy and physiology returns to normal after 6 weeks, so they have no excuse after 6 weeks. Get up and do stuff. Shrinkage of the uterus is called involution, and breastfeeding consists in involution. That might be another thing you might want to tell them. Involution will start sooner, better weight loss. Let's talk about baby planning. We can abstain, of course, if we want to fit. That's not really a workable solution. Sterilization is another idea. You go in and take out the testicles, castrate them. That's not that viable either. You could do a what else? Short of castration? Vasectomy. Sterilization, we could do what? In the female. Tubal ligation, what happens there? That's the tying your tubes, which is really going to be a ligation, which is going to be a cutting, right? And also usually a cauterization of either end. The burning it, trying to heal the tissue. But incredibly enough, sometimes it doesn't work. Does it jump over? Builds a bridge? ectopic, but usually you can get a vaginal birth. The idea is, even though you've burned both ends, it's going to be scar tissue. So the scar tissue actually form. But there are two things. The scar tissue is going to be forming over them. The idea is, stand up in court. I forget what there's a legal term for it. Basically, the contraceptive thing is all sometimes they'll have one of them, maybe. But typically, it's just a space occupying thing that causes the uterus to send out messages that they expect to be able to get in there. It's like a coil. Stimulates that, so the body thinks it is pregnant. If the progesterone decreases, especially increases actually, progesterone will decrease. So progesterone is going to stay basically the same. Part of it's got to be hanging out. So part of it can go to the cervix. Also, for women, before you can't, well, it's not like kids, they just have an extraction. But a big thing is that women sometimes get menopause. And they actually get implanted in the center of the main tissue. So, it's got its problems. Yeah, it should be taken out and put it out. So it is like a surgical procedure. An intrauterine device. Okay, so one of the methods that has been recommended as far as family planning is the symptomothermal method, the old Vatican roulette. But modified. Well, the symptoms are going to be the cervical mucus, which is usually going to be sort of an eggy-like substance, or egg-like substance, around when the person's fertile. And body temperature will also raise, not that much, about 0.5 degree, unless that will occur at ovulation. And as we also know, it's going to have an increase in LH. Combine all those, you've got a pretty good indication of when not to have sex. The good thing about this is that it's not dependent upon the female. Both males and the female have to like to breed. What that means is we can have sex 50 days. So they're both involved. The also neat thing about it is if they do decide to get pregnant, then they can just reverse the procedure. And that doesn't seem to play with the more contraceptive play with the hormonal system. People can't get pregnant afterwards, sometimes people get more pregnant afterwards. Now clinically, we mentioned N-100. Hysterectomy. What? Oral sex. to this thing on the other rabbit. Take out the uterus and they cut off the talk about the
patient? Eyesight?
Yeah. Peripheral vision? S-Y. First aid? Thursday, don't tell me. Primary, thank you. Also, with neurosyphilis, you could get baldness. You can also get paresis. Paresis is going to be a loss of feeling. You can also get what's called gun barrel. Sights. If the individual were to have sex in any of these stages, you could have a kid who would be blind. Blind child. And then also the kid could be born with a extremity deficiency called Sabre shins. The tibia is actually bowed laterally. And they also turn, they also rotate. So it looks sort of like a saber. Now, what happens is it's just the tibias, or the rickets, the whole... Yeah, they usually give braces and stuff like that. The corset? Yeah, they do. Usually they're treated. treatment, of course, is going to be antibiotics. The problem is if the bacteria, and it's a spiral, that kind of bacteria is called a spiral. It really loves the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. The dorsal horn, as you remember, was responsible for sensory, specifically proprioception, and also, yes, we have a rod-based gait, we have plastic feet, and cavies. So cavies is going to be here, called cavies dorsalis. Yes, in any of these stages, once a person gets the treatment, which is antibiotic, they'll stop at that stage. But they're still stuck with whatever they've got. If they have neural syphilis, baldness will stay, the paresis will stay. They may not get to the point of gun barrel sight. That's where they go squint, because their pupils don't close with the light. A chancre. A chancre is a, it looks like an exploded jelly donut on the penis. Yeah, it looks like a fat, big. Well, you don't get reinfected. The difficulty is the female may not know until it gets into this stage, and this stage may not be for 30 years later after the infection. So sometimes the female will notice the rash, but the chancre they might not notice because, you know, it could be inside. So sometimes the best diagnosis for primary syphilis is the male or the female. Because he'll get it. There once was a man from Back Bay who thought that syphilis just went away. He thought that a chancre was only a canker that healed in a week and a day. But now he's got vulgaris, or whatever they call it, paris. And his body is spread from his toes to his head, and his friends want to know where his hair is. There's more to his terrible plight. His pupils don't close with the light. He's contracted, and he has saber-chin babies, and he squints through his... He's been treated in every known way, but his spirochetes grow day by day. He's contracted his long walks with Jesus, and he thinks he's the queen of the man. So what ultimately happens? And he goes, "Pickle for Coca Puffs." So it's not a very nice disease. What would be another STD? HIV? Gonorrhea, as we talked about. What else? Chlamydia? Jennifer Woods. Herpes. Herpes. Okay. Pelvic inflammatory disease. It can be a sequelae to STDs or not. But it's not an STD. But pelvic inflammatory disease. We've got three different kinds of herpes. We have genital herpes. We also have the chancre, not the chancre, the canker. The canker sores, that's another kind of herpes. The third one is the other one mentioned, herpes zoster. Zoster is really coming from the chicken pox virus. It's a mutant. Why they name three different ones the same? I don't know whether the oral herpes comes from someone else or not. Probably. Definitely genital herpes doesn't come from someone. Herpes zoster, of course, doesn't. It just comes from the virus. I'm not sure. Not chicken pox. Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's an infection. Yeah. Yeah, if you have the outbreak of shingles, the yeah, so it must be coming from somebody else. Okay, let's talk about cervical cancer and also uterine cancer. Cervical cancer would be, it's a quality if you have sex. So intercourse is caused cervical cancer for a variety of reasons. If you do not have sex, then you could have uterine cancer. So cervical cancer is more treatable. Uterine cancer will take you out. So it seems like somebody telling us something. So if you have less of a risk if you have children of having uterine cancer. So if you have the ability to have kids, but you don't have sex. If you have kids, you won't have uterine cancer. In fact, you won't have children. So if you have none, from HPV. Yeah. Yeah. But it's highly treatable. Signs of ovulation, as we already mentioned, was the cervical intercourse.